Our lips shouldn't touch.
Move over, darling.
I like it too much.
Move over, darling.
That gleam in your eye.
The 1950s housewife we know and love, the retro image of a pretty lady with her permed hair neatly set, bright red lipstick, a flowery apron. She is baking rock buns and making jam sandwiches for Simon and Jane, the calf Kidston-esque gay view of those days of domestic bliss after the hardships of the Second World War. But in reality, it was not so rose-tinted, as the women spent 60 or 70 hours a week doing housework. They could not get a mortgage in their own name. They could only get contraception if they married. Rachel Cook, journalist for The Observer and The New Statesman, decided to find out if it was another side to their story. Jane found 10 extraordinary women, has written a book called Her Brilliant Career. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you for having me.
So all the 10 women had careers. Was that really so unusual in the 1950s?
Well, the women in my book are exceptional. And I'm not claiming anything other than that. But it's important to remember that by the end of the 50s, about 30% of women were working, because there were all these lovely new things like refrigerators and Formica and ready meals, which people wanted to spend their money on. And so lots of women started to work so they had a little bit extra. But the women in my book are, they're proper full on, you know, big bald pioneers who had pioneering work lives and pioneering private lives. They are exceptional, but because there are 10 of them and because they each have a very different career, that tells you the story of the 50s through them. And I hope that people will get a different feeling for it, that it's not just this sepia, you know, decade of brownness, and, you know, and as you say, that it wasn't just housewives, that people were doing other things and lots of exciting things were happening. I was just determined that 1963, which is sort of the start of the feminists, that that hadn't just come out of nowhere, you know, and that not everyone, you know, there must have been people thinking about these things. It wasn't just sort of like a light coming on. Yeah. So I wanted to, what I wanted to do was to make a kind of bridge between the war, which had liberated so many women because they had joined the auxiliary services and they were driving ambulances and mm-hmm. so on, and 1963. And I wanted to prove to people that, you know, people did have sex lives, they did have interesting work lives, and also there was a lot of work to do. You know, Britain needed to be rebuilt, and some of these women were involved in that.
Can you set the scene for us for the 1950s for, yes, to being a woman?
Well, I got the idea for the book from my Urquhart sideboard. I know that you've just been in my kitchen, so you might have spotted it. And that was what got me thinking about it, because that seemed like a very modern piece of furniture. The 50s was, strange as it may seem, it was a very modern time, in the sense that new buildings were going up, people were wearing new fashions, they had new kinds of furniture. However, if you were a woman, it was tough. You already mentioned a lot of women spent 70 hours a week doing housework. Contraception, pretty hard to get. You had to prove you were married. You know, mortgage, impossible to get unless you had a man's signature on it.
Oh, yeah, and you couldn't have an abortion.
No, either. And you That's couldn't illegal. Have an abortion. That was still illegal. Mm. But, of course, that's the surface of things. If you look underneath, I mean, abortion is a good example. We tend to think of abortion in the 1950s in that Vera Drake way, yeah, you know, in back streets, illicit with a knitting needle. And of course, actually, if you were middle class or posh and you knew the right people and you had the right number of pound notes in your wallet, you could get an abortion. I mean, I've used the example of Diana Dawes, who had 3 abortions. And the first one was probably a bit of a backstreet job. But the second and third abortions, you know, they were sort of off Harley Street doctors who performed them, and she paid for them. And the other example I use is Penelope Mortimer, who was the first Mrs. John Mortimer, who was a brilliant novelist. And she, you know, had fallen pregnant. And John Mortimer, you know, suggested to her she had an abortion and put her in touch with the person who would perform it. And actually, in her novels, you know, there's a young girl who has an abortion, and it's not such a big deal. So constantly you've got to go behind sort of what has become almost like mythology. And of course, it's mythology that we've got from things like Call the Midwife, Mad Men. So we just have this, it's like a patina that you have to kind of shatter a bit and get behind it. We associate the decade, you know, with the angry young men.
Yes.
And I've got this idea that there were angry young women. You know, there were films about the plight of women. The example I've used is Yield to the Night, which is a brilliant film, in fact, starring Diana Dawes, about a woman who's accused of the murder of her boyfriend. She's a kind of pre-Ruth Ellis figure. But she's an angry young woman. You know, she wants to earn her living. She sleeps with her boyfriend, you know, nothing bad happens. She wants something more. But of course, it's the men who write the history. So all these things fall out of the picture. And we all know about, you know, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning and Look Back in Anger, but we don't know about Woman in Dressing Gown and Yield to the Night. So I've tried really to point people in the direction of films and books that I think are interesting and in many instances better. I mean, you know, the novels of the 50s, I think the ones by women are much better, actually.
Some good ones that we can read.
Well, I've done a list at the back and I've done one good one for each decade. But, you know, there are fantastic novels that you can read by Elizabeth Jenkins, by Elizabeth Taylor, by Rose Macaulay, by my favourite, Barbara Commons, who writes mad, deranged novels. One of her novels is about a woman who levitates her way to freedom. These are books you have to seek out, but they're so rewarding and they're so much more rewarding, I think, than reading The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, which is slightly dreary.
So let's talk about a cookery writer, which I'd never heard of. I was so shocked because she sold more copies than Elizabeth David. And her name was Patience Gray.
Yes.
She seems like she's fascinating. She's a bit of a bohemian up there.
Yes, she's my favourite, actually, in the book. Because some of them I've kind of grown to loathe a bit because I've been living with them for so long. But Patience, I've never fallen out of love with. As you say, people associate the 50s with Elizabeth David. You know, everyone's on rations. There's no food. It's really horrible. There's nothing to eat. And then Elizabeth David comes back from the Mediterranean and says, what about moules marinières? But of course, the fact is, no one really read Elizabeth David until the 60s and 70s. Because they were only known by a cognoscenti because they were only published in hardback. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hardbacks were expensive then. Mm-hmm. Patience Gray's book, Plat du Jour, was published as a Penguin and it sold 100,000 copies within, I think, 4 months.
Wow.
It was the biggest selling cookbook of the 50s. And it's, you know, it's a modern cookbook in the sense that it's all about cooking something in a dish and bringing that to the table. So it's the way we eat now, which is in our kitchens. But it has things in it that would have been exotic. So it's full of things like olive oil, sea salt, garlic.
Now, how did she know about these things?
Well,
her life must have brought them.
She had travelled. She'd been to Romania as a teenager. She was from a very posh family and she had a cook. But they ate nursery food, you know, spotted dick.
Yeah.
But then as a teenager, she had this very wild side. She went to Romania. So she had been abroad, which most women had not.
Mm.
And then after that, she had made efforts to travel to the continent. But I think her own first effort at cooking when she moved to London was supposed to be a disaster. She was living in some awful bedsit.
Yeah.
She got a sheep's head. And the whole place stank of this boiling sheep's head. And it was all just terrible. So I think, you know, she was self-taught and she was a single mum. So she had to pay her way. So she had to do all these other jobs. She was a consultant at the Festival of Britain. You know, she later worked as a journalist. But anyway, this book made her name and that was how she went to work.
Why don't we know her?
Well, it's a good question. I think Elizabeth David has crowded everyone out, you know, everyone else out. Patience Gray is very well known in foodie circles now because she had a kind of second life where she went to Puglia and lived as a peasant. I mean, really poor. And she wrote a marvellous book called Honey from a Weed, which is all about subsistence living and eating things like weeds and foxes. And it is a marvellous book and a kind of classic. And so
that's a bit of a cult book.
Yeah, yes. So she's known in that world, but she's not well known in the way that Elizabeth David was.
Mm.
Her legacy, I would say, for those women who were first cooking in the 50s, Plat du Jour would have been the book they would have used. And so we can trace ourselves back to them through our mothers and our grandmothers in a way that we probably can't with Elizabeth David. Because, I mean, I don't know about your family, but in my family, it was my parents who discovered Elizabeth David, not my grandparents.
Yeah.
But so I think that in the 50s, it would have been Patience Gray, whose work, you know, was known. Plat du Jour is still in print. It has never fallen out of print. Mm. You know, maybe there'll be...
Have you tried cooking from it?
Yes, I have.
Successful? They're,
you know, that's the other thing. Recipe writing has changed. Mm. You know, now recipe writers tell you practically when you should wash your hands. Mm. Those writers...
A bit more vague.
Yeah, then. More vague. Yeah. And also they're telling you, they're trying to reassure you about scary things like garlic, you know, which it's hard to explain how terrified people were of garlic. You know, the idea that you would actually chop it up and put it in something, this was just horrifying.
So they were scared of the smell?
Yeah, the smell. Mm. And people were so timid about it. So it's a combination of being reassuring about new things, but there are loads of gaps where you have to fill them in because they don't baby you in the way that food writers do now.
So, like, strange things like take dried onions and you think, well, where do I get dried? No, does it got things in it that you think, where would I find that?
Well, it has things that we would never use, substitutes.
Oh,
because
right.
of course, well, you know, because of course pasta was hard to get.
Yeah.
So, you know, it basically it's just spaghetti or macaroni.
Yeah.
So using things like that, using watercress instead of rocket, that kind of thing. Mm. And all, you know, she assumes that most of your herbs will be dried.
Yeah.
That, you know, you'll only have two or three spices. And she's also having to advise you about where you might get things. Patience was in love with a shop, which was also where Elizabeth David bought a lot of her stock when she opened her cookery shop called Madame Cadex in Soho. And it was an extraordinary emporium of pots and pans. And Madame Cadec was famous because during the war, it was next door to a restaurant where during the war they had sold horse meat because, of course, people were dying for a steak. Mm. So it was a kind of legendary spot, foodie spot in Soho. And Madame Cadec's place was full, you know, these huge pyres of pots and pans, and you would have to go in and say, I want that, please, and pray that it didn't topple over you. But there just weren't cook shops, you know.
No.
There just weren't.
Mm. Then we're introduced to three women in a ménage à trois of a journalist, Nancy Spain, Joan Werner-Laurie, and Sheila Van Damme, who ran the Windmill nightclub in Soho.
That's right.
And they were friends of Marlene Dietrich. I mean, sorry, these women are just like the coolest women on earth.
They live together. So Nancy Spain was a journalist, as you said, at a time, she worked at the Express at a time when, you know, millions of people read it. And she also wrote very camp detective novels. She fell in love with Joan Werner-Laurie, who was the editor of She, which in those days was taboo busting because it mentioned things like menstruation and, you know, things that people didn't really talk about. And they were a couple. But Nancy was very promiscuous, as you have suggested. Marlene Dietrich was one of her paramours, and she had many affairs. The really long and serious affair was with a woman called Jeanette Spanier, who was the directrice of Balmain, the designer.
Wow.
And they had some good times together. And so while Nancy was playing away, Joan palled up with Sheila Van Damme, who was, first of all, a rally car driver. She was the fastest woman in Europe. She famously beat Stirling Moss in a race once.
Yay!
And in fact, on the circuit, Stirling Moss used to wash her smalls because they were in these boarding houses, and I bet he doesn't admit that now.
Yeah.
And then when she was a really successful rally car driver, but she began to be afraid of dying because it was so dangerous. And then she came back to London and she ran the Windmill Theatre, which her father had run. And the Windmill Theatre, for those people who don't know, was famously the theatre that never closed in the war, and where women could pose naked so long as they didn't move.
That's because of legal obligations.
Yeah,
couldn't be a
that's
moving,
right.
naked
That's
figure.
Right. The Lord yeah. Chancellor said it was all right if you were like a statue, basically. And Sheila loved the Windmill and she ran it and was very close to all the Windmill girls. So the three of them were in this kind of menage. And then Nancy had a child of her own.
So secretly, what did she buy then?
No. Well, I mean, I don't know, but my sense is that she was, you know, only interested in women. But I think she wanted to give, I think she wanted to have a baby and give it to Joan as a, in a way to complete their family.
Yeah.
So she got pregnant. I mean, the mind boggles at how she actually, you know, went about going to bed with this particular man, but she got pregnant. He was the husband of her friend Marjorie Allingham, the detective novelist. Mm.
So he must have agreed to it then.
Yeah, he. I don't know if he knew that she was pregnant. Why? Because Marjorie had longed for a child and he wouldn't give her one. Oh. So it was a very sad story. Yeah. And Marjorie certainly didn't know that Nancy's baby was her husband's baby.
God.
Anyway, she had the baby and immediately handed her over to Joan. And the two little boys were brought up as brothers, which was a necessary deceit. I understand that. But in time, it became a secret that burnt a lot of people because Joan and Nancy in 1963 were killed in a plane crash. And at that point, the boys discovered that they weren't brothers.
And how old were they then?
They were still at school. They were 12 and I think 10. Not quite sure, but they were young. They were little. Yeah. And this was terribly painful and, you know, complicated. But anyway, and poor Sheila had to identify the bodies. Yeah. But the three of them lived together and it was an extraordinary relationship because Nancy was so famous. I mean, to give you an idea of how famous she was sort of a bit like Chris Evans or Terry Wogan, you know. She was on television, she was on the radio and she
was famous for interviewing personalities.
Yes, that's right.
Which were celebrities
yes,
of now.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But people used to use the word personality. Now we call them celebrity, but it was the same thing.
Yeah.
And she was one herself. She wrote two celebrity memoirs in which she hints all the time about her sexuality.
Wow, that's so interesting.
It is interesting, yeah. But she never actually admits it. But she talks about Joan and how much she adores her without ever saying she's my partner or my wife.
Maybe that's the way gay people acted then.
Yes,
it was just
yes.
It was telling people without telling them.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think people definitely understood that she was different. They may not quite have understood what that involved. She made various efforts to cover up her sexuality, the most famous of which was she hinted that she was going to marry Gilbert Harding, who was also a TV personality. And he was as famous as her, but he was gay too.
Yeah.
I think as the 60s came along, once they were in sight, I think she began to be nervous that it would be revealed that she was a lesbian. And that would have been difficult because, you know, she presented things like Woman's Hour, which were very wholesome programmes.
Yeah.
And, you couldn't, in those days, admit to, I mean, you know,
to being an invert.
No, exactly. Yeah. In a way, they're a strange combination, these three women, because in one way they had amazingly joyful lives. You know, they had super adventures. They knew all these famous people. You know, they had a party that Paul McCartney came to. I mean, that's how famous they were. And their lives were replete and in many ways happy, and they loved their work. But because of these secrets that they had, there's a sad side to it too. And of course, after Nancy and Joan were killed, Sheila, you know, more or less became semi-reclusive and was treated for depression. And
I bet.
So it was because, you know, she just lost this whole world that she'd built. And of course, she couldn't quite admit, you know.
Yeah, but she lost the love of her life.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's a strange story.
Yeah, just think nowadays it would have been completely different. She could go for therapy.
Yes, exactly.
Everything.
And people would have said, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a reading about, if you read that chapter, it's quite a weird chapter to read because you feel so cheered by them and you laugh at all their jokes and their you know, the camp things they did. And then it has this terrible,
tragic
end.
Yeah.
And actually they're sort of, in the context of the books, they're anomalies really, because in the main I want the book to be inspiring and cheering, but they are sad, and you do feel that they made maybe a wrong decision about the boys and not revealing to them.
Now we've got what chance to talk to about one more woman. We can't go through more. So I'm wondering whether there's one that you'd like to talk about.
Well, one that I think is really interesting is Rose Heilbronn, who was the first woman QC, the first woman judge, the first woman to defend in a murder trial. And the main reason why I think she's interesting is she sort of sums up the book. She became a lawyer. She wasn't from a privileged background. She became a lawyer in Liverpool during the war. The men had all gone away to fight. And so the solicitors had no choice but to give the work to a woman barrister, which happened to be Rose. So she got started. And by the time the war was over, she was well set up. She was a brilliant defence lawyer. She saved man after man after man from the noose.
Wow.
And of course, people took a great interest in murder trials then because of hanging. She was invited to defend a woman called Violet Wright. And Violet Wright lived on a houseboat in Ebbsfleet in Essex. She had a complicated life, lots of men, children by different men, you know, that sort of thing.
So really, she was quite modern.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. She was modern. She had a boyfriend who wanted to go to Australia and she wanted to go with him. But she had two rather inconvenient problems, which were her twin sons. One night there was a terrible fire on the houseboat and she escaped and all the people who were staying there. But her two boys died.
How old were they?
They were little toddlers. And it seems pretty clear that she probably was involved in, you know, the arson that led to this. Anyway, Rose was invited to defend her and it seemed hopeless. All the evidence was there, but also the jury was told about Violet's private lives and that wouldn't have played well. And it seemed like she would definitely hang. And then, you know, in the closing hours of the trial, Rose stood up to make her closing speech. She said that Vicky Violet, she had two names, that's a sign of how complicated her life was, but she said that Vicky could not possibly have planned the fire because when the police and the firemen arrived, she was wearing her rollers. And what woman in the 50s would do that? And the jury bought it and she got a manslaughter conviction. She did 2 years and then she went off to Australia.
Wow.
And this was extraordinary. And the headlines, if you look at the newspapers of that time, I mean, it's just, you know, the headlines all about this, you know, the curlers that won it and all of that. And of course, lots of stories about Rose. Is this the cleverest woman in Britain? I mean, it seems amazing now when you think that people are famous. Women are famous basically because of showing their bums nowadays. Yeah. That's what it comes down to. Yeah. Then the newspapers were admiring her for her huge intellect.
Fabulous.
And that, to me, sums up my book in a way, because on the one hand, you've got, it's a time when people are prepared to believe that don't go out in your rollers. Yeah. So that's the old. But the new is that the most important person in the courtroom is a woman. You know, these are women who are on the cusp. You know, things are changing and they are unusual and in some ways shocking. She was famously beautiful with a mellifluous voice.
She really was.
Yes.
Everyone should see the photographs.
Yes.
We'll put it up on the website.
Yes.
Stunning.
Lovely.
Gorgeous.
And she kept a very nice house, so the press approved of that. She had a small daughter. You know, the press would follow her at the weekends to see what she bought at the shop. You know, and so she, in a way, she had it both ways because she was the housewife advocate. You know, she was a career woman, but she also was keeping home.
So she kind of played the whole game.
Yeah, and that made her the press like her. The other thing was she wasn't allowed, lawyers were not allowed to give interviews. It was a bit like the Queen, you know.
So she's mysterious.
Yes, yeah. She was unknowable. Yeah.
What happened to her career then?
She carried on. She rose and rose and rose. I mean, she had lots of setbacks. She wasn't appointed a High Court judge as early as she should have been.
Just because she was a woman?
I suspect so. Mm. And she was a great campaigner for women. She spoke a lot at, you know, Rotarian dinners and things like that about how it was really important that more women should go into the law. You know, I mean, she knew what it was like when she was on the circuit, the Northern Circuit as a judge. She couldn't even have dinner with the other men because the messes where they used to stay were all set up for men and they were sort of segregated.
Good
she
girl.
Used to have to eat on her own.
Wow. So lonely at the top.
Yeah, lonely at the top. Mm. And in a way, Not so much has changed. But I think she's a real heroine, I think.
Rachel Cook, it's called Her Brilliant Career, 10 Extraordinary Women of the 50s. It's been a delight to meet you today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for being on Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
This is no big surprise anymore, 'cause you fooled me before. I'm all in a spin.
Move over, darling.
About to give in.